back. This is Gary Parr, editorial director of Maintenance Technology Magazine, and we're back again with Ken Bannister. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
I'm going to be all right. How about you?
Good, thank you. Great to be back.
Yes. So another installation of Lubrication Talk with Ken Bannister. And for those who have not joined us before, Ken is co-author with Heinz Block of the book entitled Practical Lubrication for Industrial Facilities. This is the third edition. And we've already established that if you don't have one, go get one. And Ken is also the managing partner and principal consultant for EngTech Industries, Inc. And they're located in Interkip, Ontario. And he specializes in implementation of lubrication effectiveness reviews to ISO 55001 standards, asset management systems, and training. And, of course, Ken writes monthly for us on lubrication, one of my favorite monthly installations. So glad to be able to talk to you this time, Ken. We're talking about lubrication delivery lines in your article and the role that they play in equipment reliability. So, obvious and first question out of the gate is, why do we care about lube delivery lines? Why would you take time to write a full article on lube delivery lines?
Well, it's kind of like the forgotten cousin, and yet it's an integral component of the lubrication system in of itself. A lubrication system is made up of a pump, divider valves as such, and filters and the like, and reservoirs. All of those elements come together, and what pulls them all together are the lubrication lines themselves, from a primary line to a secondary line to the point. And if you don't do it right, or there's a problem with these elements, then the lubrication doesn't get to the point from the pump. It's as simple as that. So it's an important component in the system itself.
And in most cases, rather small piping, or it depends on the application, I'm sure, but plastic, steel, depends, pressure, location, all kinds of it depends, right?
Yeah, there is, so when we're looking at a system like this, there are small pumps, there are large pumps, and we can go anywhere from 3 millimeters, or a 1/8 inch line ID, right all the way up to a 2 inch pipe, for very, very large installations of thousands of systems, and like a dual line system in a cement plant or something like that, which can run up to 2,000-3,000 points. And so you need to put a lot of grease or a lot of oil through the system, in order to make it all work, right, hydraulically. So obviously it all depends on the number of points that's being used, the type of pump, and the type of whether it's oil or it's grease, the medium that you're putting through the line. So there's lots of different things and factors that we look at there. So I guess let's start off with materials, okay? So materials, the typical type of materials that are utilized in lube lines, run the gambit from straightforward copper, which is not a really good one to use. A lot of people use copper because it's quick and it's easy to bend, but it doesn't look very good often, because it can be bent with the fingers and not so much with the, don't need the tube benders to do that. And it's fairly thin, moves, as I said, it's easy to pipe up, and it's quick and dirty. But in doing so, copper also work hardens when you make a bend on it. If you try to bring it back a couple of times, you'll see white stress lines at the corners there, and eventually it'll weep and leak itself. So copper is not a really good one. Also, if you use straight copper piping in a recirculative oil system, the copper works as a disadvantage to the oil, in as much as you get copper traces into the oil, and we're causing all kinds of problems there that we might think a bearing is shedding at that point. There might be a problem with the bearing, and it's actually coming from the lines. So we don't want those phantom elements coming into play if we're doing oil analysis. The next thing that people normally go to is like steel that is copper coated. And again, these are usually the smaller lines, like the 5/32 to the 3/8 lines. And so steel is is a much more robust. These would easily be like a thin wall steel one, and it's a carbon steel, and so it's copper coated, so it won't rust in a rusty environment. And that's typically where you look at that element, that type of line. Moving to the plastics, which a lot of people love to go with plastic lines, because you can bunch them together. Just it's quick and it's cheap and it's easy until you have a problem, and then it's very, very difficult to find out where the problem is when you've got 15 lines bundled together, and it's like spaghetti. And you know what? I had a mentor, Tadeusz Monkiewicz, who is this Polish designer, who is a brilliant man. And he always said, it's the first element of good design is that it's got to look right and it's got to look proportional. And so if you put a great big bunch of plastic lines, and you don't loom them together or anything like that, but they just all gang together and they go off in all directions, it's kind of like, do you have confidence in that system? When I look at that and I think, no, I don't really have confidence in that system. If it goes wrong, it can go wrong anywhere. And it looks like it's temporary. And so the best type of line that we can have out there is a straightforward steel line, which is a good wall thickness. The wall thickness is chosen according to the line pressure. It will hold the greatest of pressure in the lines themselves. And there's nothing more prettier than someone who's got a really good tubing job of the lines with good bends, quality bends, and a lot of thought, with all piping runs running parallel to each other across the machine and then branching off. Very, very easy to troubleshoot. It looks like it was meant to be there, and it's an integral part of the machine's design as a result. And it instills a lot of confidence, and it also lasts the longest as a result. Cost a little bit more to put in place, but in doing so, the line is, as we said before, is a very, very important part of the lubrication system. And when there is a problem, you want to be able to troubleshoot that as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and that's one of the things in reading the article that struck me, is there's when you talk about troubleshooting, there's kind of a dilemma. If maybe I'm wrong, but it struck me there's kind of a dilemma when you put these delivery line systems in that you need to be able to service them and monitor them for leaks or whatever, but you also don't want them exposed where they could get damaged by a fork truck or any number of things coming and going. So you kind of have to find that happy medium between accessible and protected. Is that a fair assessment of what I read out of this?
That's absolutely correct, Gary. As you put it right there, in terms of if it's sort of hanging out there, it is very vulnerable to being taken out by an errant lift truck or someone who's just carrying some steel or carrying something and boom, catches the lube line and just pulls it. If it's plastic, it's even worse. And this is the key to good design, right? Which is the lube line shouldn't cross over any other lines if you can help it. They should run off in parallel tracks with each other, and they should be firmly fitted and screwed using the proper type of connectors to the wall or to the steel framework that around the machine. And we should, if possible, if a line is going to float in the air as it goes across the machine, it should be on the inside of the machine, not on the outside of the machine where it becomes vulnerable at that point to being hit by something.
Okay. I always like it when I read these things and I actually have insight. I'm so proud of myself. So what are some of the primary problems that people encounter with these lube delivery lines? Whether they're obviously, if they're poorly designed, you just invited a whole bunch of problems, whether you like it or not. But a well-delivered or well-designed delivery line, what are some of the things that problems that you have to be aware of? Things that maybe you want to consider when you're doing your design?
Okay, good question. So what we need to look at, okay, one of the primary areas that we have problems with lines is connection leaks. So therefore, what can happen is that if you're running steel or you're running any length of line, is to cut the length of line to the length that it's required so it can go in one run. If you've got to connect, so we get a great deal on 4 foot length piping. Well, that's not good if you've got to go 16 feet and put three connectors in there, because you've just tripled. Actually, you've done more than that. You've actually six times, because there's two connections on both sides of each pipe. So there's three connectors and to four connectors there, and you've there's eight times the problem that you could have as a result of leakage at each connection leak. So if you can run it in one line from the lubrication block to the end fitting, we only have two fittings to worry about. So it's much, much easier to troubleshoot. And in doing so, in that regard as well, if the line is going to run into an area where we cannot see it and it comes out as on the other side of the equipment, we need to identify it easily. So this line, we know what it is going in, but we don't know exactly where it is coming out. And so there's two specific methods that people use. They can use a lettering convention or a coloring convention. And the lettering convention usually will have a P for a primary line, which means it's from the pump to the metering valve, and S for a secondary line, which from the secondary valve, from the metering valve to the lubrication point. So it's P or S. So it can be a P1, and then it can be an S1 if it's just a straight through. And we can have S3, S4, S5, S6, and then as the line goes through, we'd identify it on the other side as well. So we know exactly, oh, this is S6 on this side, this is S5 on this side, and we know exactly where it goes to on the other side of the machine because we've identified it as such. And they could be like collar sleeves, like you do for tagging birds and stuff like that, or for doing electrical tags. They can be done. There's multiple different ways we can tag the lines. If you see in the article, there's actually a little brass tag system on there. So they've got little brass key tags on there with the line stamped on it. And even if they get dirty, they can just be cleaned off, and you can tell very quickly which is what line. And that should correlate to the drawing, to the schematic in that regard, because you never get an actual drawing on these systems because they're piped as they go along. So you have a schematic, but at least we know which ones we're reading by the line numbers now, which helps us troubleshoot it much easier as we go through. And so other types of connection leaks are primarily caused, especially when we've got a taper fitting, people don't put enough Teflon tape on there. Like any piping or any plumbing system, Teflon tape is absolutely crucial, as in any other system, right? So to ward off any leaks. And because these are tubing and not piping, it is, as long as we're going to the larger steel piping, if we're going to the tubing side of it, the smaller diameters, we're going to use ferrules. And these ferrules are beveled, and they're different for steel and different for the plastic and the copper style lines. The steel ones having two chamfers on them. And so when you clamp them up, they clamp up tight and give that connection. And if you have to move that connection after that and undo it, usually that can bring in a problem right there. So it's first time only. After that, you're usually going to have to cut. Well, it's recommended you cut the line and redo it. It's just like running an electrical line. You don't cut it and then kind of, try and muster it together with connections all through the system. You want a single run always for the least amount of trouble. Right. So you'd have to redo the entire line if you botched it up first time. And you've got to put the right ferrule in for it to ensure that you don't get a leak when it goes under pressure. Mm-hmm. And these systems have to be tested under pressure too to ensure that. And then that also brings us to the point of pressure in terms of choosing the right line, okay? Because lines are all different thicknesses, and so you have to work with the tubing people to let them know what kind of pressure you're going to be putting through that line, and what is the pressure drop for larger pipe systems? We talked about a 2-inch pipe system there on a dual line. You start off with a 2-inch, drop it down to a 1.5, drop it down to a 1, and dropping it down to a 1/2 to a 1/4 at the line end, so we can ensure that there's an equal pressure drop across the entire system, so we don't build up pressure in the system, and it relieves it naturally all the way through. So again, that's part of good piping design, as a result of that, putting fluids through piping, right? So it's fluid dynamics. So that's only on the larger systems. The smaller ones there, again, we just have to ensure that we're choosing the right tubing thickness on there. Because again, if we're putting oil through, usually oils run at lower pressure systems. They're running up to 800, 1,000 PSI, usually something like that at the most. Most of them are low pressure systems. And if we're using grease, if we think about most grease pumps around 40 to 50 to 1 on an airtight pump, and so you're looking at 50 to 1 on the pressure and stuff like that, you're only looking at 4,000 pounds maximum on 5,000 pounds on 100 psi running through the system. Most will run around 80-85 psi, so we'll get 4,000 pounds line pressure in there. Which most lines will handle that, even the plastic lines. But once you go into a manual system, you have to be really careful, because you can drive up to 15,000 psi through a hand grease gun. And if it's deadheading, for instance, if the bearing is turned and it deadheads back through the system, you're going to be developing up to that kind of pressure, and it will be the line that will blow. And you're thinking you've unblocked it and the line's blown somewhere, it's going to be hard to troubleshoot if you haven't got the right, identifiers on the line, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. That moment where it, you feel it release and you go, oh, good, everything's good. And then you realize, no, it's not. It just got worse. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, lots of systems will tell you too, Gary, in terms of the, especially the progressive divider systems. You can actually have a line indicator that will tell you that the line is overpressured, and it pops out a pin and it bleeds out of the block. And then you know what line number it's going to, what bearing it goes to then. And that's where you start to do your checkers on that secondary line in that regard. And it could be lots of things. I mean, there are certain elements where we get blockages. And that's usually when a line gets crimped, something's hit it, and a line gets crimped in that regard. Or if the line has come off and become loose because of vibration, or if it's broken it's work hardened and broken because of excessive vibration, what will happen then is that it will just bleed out. Now, there's no indicator for loss of lube in that case. So it behooves us to actually do a line check on a regular basis as part of the PM check.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, as I was going through this article, and based on our discussion last month about sight level gauges, curiosity got the best of me in terms of these delivery line systems. Is this a place where you might put in a drain port or a sampling port or any kind of filtration, or is this the wrong place to put this kind of thing?
Actually, that's a very good question, Gary. It's not one that's actually asked very much, so it's quite insightful. when we're looking at systems like this, let's take the first one, a drain port. Where you might find a drain port is not so much on grease systems. You might find a relief valve that you can open up and allow it to relieve the grease to relieve or the pressure, and in essence, that's like a drain port in that regard. But most, if we're taking draining reservoirs, it's usually at the reservoir, like we talked in the last session there. They can use the reservoir tubes there to actually open them up and drain as part of it right there. So in a line system like that, where you would find that is in particular is a mist system. Now, again, it makes mist in a large diameter pipe, and it goes and the pipe is designed to move up and up and up as we go along, because now sometimes it requires the pipe to go down and come back up again, and that's called a reverse or an inverse loop to beat an obstacle in some way. And at that point, the mist will still travel, but we will get some reclassification of the mist into straight oil. And in that particular case, we would put a drain valve to actually drain that out in that area. So that's other things that we could do in terms of things like sampling ports, where we might get sampling ports in the lines, particularly these newer style sampling ports, to take oil analysis on recirculative systems. So it's a live sampling zone. You would find that the line would be teed, and then you would get that the ability to actually take the lube sample at that point there. And we might find sometimes the line on the primary line goes up to the main filter, the main pressure filter. That's still part of the primary line system right there. But we also get bypass lines that come out around that area too, before it reaches the primary filter. And this is what we use for depth filtration, specifically on larger systems where we want to actually perform some cleanup. So we'll actually apportion 15 to 20% of the oil on a bypass loop and take it through a depth filter to keep the oil being cleansed all the time, to take a lot of the dirt out back into the pressure system. So it keeps that oil clean. So those are a few areas of where you would find imported into the lube delivery lines.
So legitimacy in having those accessories in some of these specialty situations then?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Now, in the article, you listed 6 questions that you urge people to ask and answer ahead of time before they go to installing a lube delivery system. Six questions, and I'll just run through them. Is the system automated or manual? Then what type of automated engineering delivery system is specified? How many lubrication points are included in the system and where are they located on the machine? What lubricant type and grade/viscosity are you planning to use? In what type of working environment will the system be used? And then what is your budget? And so the 6 questions in a progression that you ask people to ask and answer as they're looking at a design for a lube delivery system. Is there any one of those 6 that stands out and says, your answer better be thus and such to this question or you're headed for trouble?
Well, I guess when you're looking at what type of automated engineering delivery system is specified, because that means are we running for oil? Are we running for grease? That would help us look specifically in terms of the number of points, what the line size has to be, and allow us to take a schematic and actually perform some physical design aspects to it. So for instance, once we know what comes off the pump, then we'd know. So if we use a progressive divider valves on them, we would take a primary valve and then break that down into secondary valves if we had, say, 80 or 100 points. Once we get those broken down to that area, we would then look at where we would place those valves so they're visual to the operator and yet in a place where they're protected. And then we would be able to do all the line takeoffs to understand how much actual line we actually need. And then you'd be able to look at how you bring them all together and gang them together correctly so you could do a quality installation. And so it looks like an engineered installation. So all of those elements have to be known ahead of time so you can actually then do a true material takeoff in that regard.
Okay. I like the last question because there was much more to it than simply what is your budget? Because what I took out of it is if your budget is if you're scrimping here, you're asking for trouble.
You know what? It really is. That's the case. And it's often the irony here is that the system that is going to give you longevity to the machine and give you good life cycle management is the first one part to go in the design stage when there is a problem with the budget. it's the first thing to be cut. Let's take the system out and put grease nipples in, right? or if we're, let's just put a manual pump in, and then we'll think about going to an automated system later on. And then things like a sacrificed, for instance, where you should have a hose when you've got a moving or a vibrating piece of equipment, and you should have quality hose that will take, that has a, will not get a memory, in essence, after 1,000 cycles. Some people will just end up putting a loop of plastic. And again, as we talked before, when anything is up in the air like that and fragile, we know what can happen to those very quickly. And it just doesn't look correct for the machine at that point. But there's all kinds of shortcuts done like that. So steel line is taken away and plastic line is put in place and becomes very difficult to, so later on to actually troubleshoot. So in the design phase, it seems like we've saved money, but in where it really matters in the operational phase, which is far longer than any design phase or build phase, is where it manifests itself in terms of loss of, you know, reduced life in the equipment and the asset itself, which creates higher downtime. And we're not talking a lot of money when we talk about doing it right versus doing it half right.
Right.
We're talking, you know.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing is you save a little money up front, and then not only do you get to do it correctly later, but then you have to deal with all that downtime and cleaning up the mess and lost revenue from lost production, all those things that just compound that few dollars that you saved up front.
Well, that's right. I mean, we did one recently, like a walking beam furnace, and a loss of a bearing in that constituted, about $7,000-$8,000 for each bearing loss, and around six a month of those things happening, which just had grease nipples on them, right? So to put in $100,000 lubrication system, a very sophisticated one for hundreds and hundreds of points on this furnace, under $100,000, the payback was like 3 months on it. So when you think of those elements, all of that downtime they put up with for many years,
yeah,
until finally somebody saw the light when it was pointed out to them what the actual cost was in that regard.
Yeah. Nobody wants to add that up. No.
It is a saying in England, there's a penny wise pound foolish, or cent wise dollar foolish, right?
So. Right, exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Ken, thank you. This is, as always, interesting and educational, and you wouldn't think there'd be all that much to worry about in a simple lube delivery system, but like everything else, do it right, plan it out right, consider all your factors, and you'll save so much down the road that it's worth the trouble.
It is, and it's an engineered approach that needs to be looked at as such, you know. And thanks again, Gary, and I look forward to the next one.
All right, thank you, Ken.